And our last headline takes us to the classroom. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in two cases that public school systems can't use race to determine enrollment. Here's NPR's Tony Cox talking with Harry Correll. Correll was a lead attorney for Parents Involved in Community Schools, a group of plaintiffs based in Seattle who won their case last week.
Some schools are better than others, quite honestly, and no systems have been hit hardest by under-resourcing and overcrowding than many of our inner-city schools, where without integration plans historically, the vast majority of African-American students wind up. How can we make sure that these schools and those students do not get left behind?
You know, I think that's one of the most important questions to come out of this. And I hope that the answer is going to be, you know, if the problem is lack of resources and weak teachers and weak administration, that the answer is to improve the resources, improve the teachers, and improve the administration, and not shuffle kids around based on their skin color. It seems to me to be looking at the wrong issue if they're looking at race, when the problem is the performance of the schools.
Mr. Correll insists that when it comes to dollars, some public schools get a lot less funding than others, and that funding has a major impact on the quality of education. Joining me now to talk about money in public schools is Bill Spriggs. He's professor and chair of economics at Howard University. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me.
So one thing that I know is that property taxes pay for a lot of what goes on in schools. And so, you know, at my age, in my late 30s, I see a lot of my friends really struggling with where should they live just based on how to take care of their kids. Explain a little bit about how property taxes affect education and how that in turn affects race.
Well, at the end of the 19th century, what a school district comprised of was a school. And early in the part of the 20th century, we realized that single school districts didn't make sense. They weren't economically viable for the type of training people were going to need for the new industrial age. And we expanded the size of school districts and went to milling or taxing based on the school district. And because this came out of an old system, it was taxing property. And that's the basis for why we get school districts being based on property tax. The problem is, in some areas like Texas, as an example of a state, where the school district may not be the entire county, the lines for the school district may be what economists would call endogenous. That is, I exclude certain people from my school district because I don't want them in my school district. And so those who have very wealthy homes can stick together. This can even be arbitrary in the sense of when you look at the expansion of some cities and over time. Virginia is an example where cities and counties are independent governing bodies, and cities in Virginia, as an example, have expanded to eat up some counties over time.
So let's break this down a little bit, though. Mm-hmm. It's legal for rich people essentially to band together and create their own school districts?
That is what can happen. And of course, it depends upon the state, because in some states, school districts are going to be the same as the county. But in some states, there may be independent school districts within counties. And where those lines get drawn can be influenced by the politics of the area. And so what becomes race and what becomes class gets blurred. And those who have wealthy homes can, in some of those states, protect themselves against having their tax dollars go to those who have less wealthy homes or don't own homes.
This is a federal ruling. And yet the federal government doesn't contribute that much of the overall budget to most schools, does it?
It does not. It influences them on the margin because it provides what are called Title I funds. These are federal dollars designed to help make up for having a lot of poor children in a district and for lack of resources in a district. And schools get some federal money for a special education, which would be federally directed. And they get money to offset the location of large federal facilities like Army bases.
You know, we've had Lester Spence, who is a professor at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, on our show. He's been a contributor for us from time to time. And his wife has been homeschooling their five kids. He's in urban Baltimore, not so far from where I grew up. And that is one very extreme and very time-consuming reaction to the fact that the schools aren't up to par. What do you see other people doing in terms of trying to address, as citizens, how they participate in the life of the schools, say, in urban areas?
Well, poor people vote with their feet more than people understand. Poor children suffer from the problem of switching schools often. Sometimes it's because the family is under economic stress and they have to move. But other times it really is because poor parents are trying to find a better school for their child. And unlike middle-class families who can buy into a school district, buy into a neighborhood, as you began the segment talking about people struggling with those kind of choices, poor people try to search around themselves in that same way. They also try to sneak out of district. So there are a number of school districts where they're close together, Washington, D.C. being one, where students sometimes sneak into the D.C. school system because they think that their suburban school isn't as good. And there are instances of kids who live in Washington, D.C. who try to sneak into suburban school districts by using an aunt's address or a cousin's address or trying to find a way to legitimize their being in district.
I know, in fact, of one case of a woman who's working now and a mother herself who went to another district and eventually had to become an emancipated minor and rent an apartment in order to finish high school in a district that was acceptable to her. Again, that's an extreme case, but really, a lot of times when you look at African-American parents are very likely to support vouchers and other means of trying to break through log jams in the public school system. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about charter schools, which are an issue we've addressed? They're public schools, but they have a little more independence?
They have a lot more independence. It depends upon the specific state in which they exist. But the primary idea is that they would be open to all children, that they would receive public money, but they would not be governed by the school system. They would have an independent board, and they would often be excluded from having teachers who are represented by the teachers' union as well. And they get to set a curriculum, and depending upon the school system, be more accountable or less accountable to standards that are set in the public school system. A problem that parents have is getting adequate and timely information on how well such a school would perform and being able to correct what happens if the school is not performing. It's difficult for parents to get that information, particularly in instances where these schools sometimes come and go for financial reasons and not because of quality reasons.
We started out by talking about the Supreme Court decision basically barring some forms of voluntary integration. We've been talking about money. Money is what you do. You're chair of economics at Howard. How does the money issue impact any kind of voluntary desegregation?
Well, it impacts it greatly because people have to have faith in the school system to want to support it. And to the extent that the school systems really do not reflect a fair and open system, you can get people to lose faith and support in that system. And Black parents and other minority parents have to feel that the school system is open and available to them to be part of that system. And to not make sure, as the court has decided, to not enforce having a fair and representative allocation of resources undermines the credibility that it is a fair and open system. We still use race as a marker because race, above and beyond all other factors, still determines life chances in the United States. It's still correlated with wealth holding much higher than it should be. It's still correlated with the chances of being unemployed much higher than it should be. Above and beyond income, above and beyond education. And so because of these markers, people look to schools to be fair, and the courts are ignoring that that's a important symbol for a public institution.
Professor, we're just about out of time. I want you to end on this note. For parents out there who are seeking information, where would you tell them to go just to learn more about this?
Well, they need to go to the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights website, the civilrights.org, to make sure they fully understand the implications of this specific case. And they need to go to the Department of Education and find out how to get information on their local school systems and the report cards and performance of their local school systems to see how they're performing on raising the standards for all children.
Professor Spriggs, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bill Spriggs is a professor and chair of economics at Howard University, and he joined me from NPR's Washington, D.C. headquarters.